It's Thursday, November 14, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The start cover of this week's issue of New York Magazine has these words in black and white, "My abortion." Inside the magazine is a series of testimonies written by women in New York and beyond about their abortion. The purpose of this cover story is to try to personalize abortion so that it can change the moral understanding of abortion in the larger culture. The background of the article, frustration and a bit of amazement on the part of the pro-abortion movement that there are so many Americans who simply still have a divided mind, if not an outright opposition, to abortion on demand. In the introduction to the testimonies, Megan Winter of New York Magazine writes, "Of all the battles in our half-century culture war, perhaps none seems further from being resolved in our laws and in our consciences than abortion. It's a fight now in its fifth decade. Yet in the past 2 years, 26 states have passed over 111 provisions restricting abortion." Let's look at those two sentences alone for a moment. Behind those two sentences is an absolute befuddlement, a bafflement on the part of liberal America that the issue of abortion is still an issue, and not just an issue, but the prime issue, as it appears, in the nation's moral conscience. The first sentence of Megan Winter's article here is really revealing. Of all the battles in our half-century culture war, let's stop there for a moment. A half-century? A culture war that has lasted for 50 years? When you think about it, this clearly takes the culture war back to the 1960s. And in the 1960s, abortion was not yet legal, certainly not nationwide. Nothing like Roe v. Wade had occurred, not until 1973. But in the 1960s, the great culture shift was beginning to take the shape of a culture war. In the 1960s, the great moral revolution that came in the post-war era, associated with all that took place in the 60s, well, that was beginning to take the shape of the culture war we know even today. The amazement that is reflected in this article is in the fact that the culture war continues. And on the issue of abortion, it continues in a very focused way. Again, Megan Winter writes that this issue, perhaps more than any other, seems further from being resolved, she says, in our laws and in our consciences. A very interesting double affirmation there. It's not just the law, she says, that's in conflict. It is the conscience of America. It appears that that latter issue is the very purpose of this cover story in the magazine, to try to move the meter on the moral side of the equation, believing that by personalizing these accounts of abortion, the moral needle will be moved. Winter writes, even in Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court was qualified in its judgment. This is a very interesting admission from a magazine like New York. She writes, an abortion was a personal decision only in the first trimester, according to the Supreme Court. In the second, states could intervene on behalf of the woman's health. Once the fetus was considered viable, a state could set whatever limitations it saw fit, end quote. That is exactly right. That is an honest and unnuanced interpretation of exactly what the Supreme Court decided in 1973. And yet, those who were pushing for abortion on demand seized upon the momentum of Roe v. Wade in order to say that after that decision, a woman could have an abortion for any reason or for no reason simply by demanding it. But that was not the decision handed down by the Supreme Court in Roe v. Wade. And yet that is how most Americans have remembered it. Those on the pro-life side have been saying for a long time that that was not the case, and the Supreme Court revisited that decision at several points, most importantly in the Casey decision, saying that the states did have a right to intervene in the second trimester and to prevent abortion after the point of viability. And that's why modern developments in terms of medicine have pushed the date of viability way back, such that many abortions routinely conducted in America a decade or so ago would or could at least now be illegal even under Roe v. Wade. In a most revealing paragraph, Winter writes, but for all the regulations and protests, despite safe, legal, and rare, and abortion is murder, those are the two arguments she's picturing being made on either side, abortion is part of our everyday experience. Nearly half of all pregnancies in America are unintended. About half of those, 1.2 million a year, will end in abortion. That is, again, a very revealing way to look at the picture. What we're talking about here is a moral equation that means, once you do the math, that approximately 25% of all pregnancies in America in any given year end in an abortion rather than a birth. As this cover story continues, it becomes even more morally revealing. For instance, Winter writes, even now, four decades after Roe, some of the women we spoke with in this magazine article, would talk only if we didn't print their real names. She says, abortion is something we tend to be more comfortable discussing as an abstraction rather than as a personal issue. As she continues to make her case, she writes, as their stories show, the experience of abortion in the United States in 2013 is vastly uneven. It varies not just by state, but also by culture, race, income, age, and family. By whether a boyfriend offered a ride to the clinic or begged her not to go. By the compassion or callousness of the medical staff. By whether she took the pill alone at home or navigated protesters outside a clinic. End quote. Megan Winter's introduction to the testimonies is itself a very morally revealing treatise. But the testimonies go far beyond the introduction. In moral power, in shock effect, and in the revelation of what abortion is really all about and how women actually get to the point of demanding and receiving an abortion. Frances Nicole, age 19, from Kentucky, writes, I don't think abortion is killing, but I'd always been against it. So why was she against it if it wasn't killing? You see, one of the most basic issues that emerges in this article is that the women having an abortion seem to know, whether they want to admit it or not, that it is the killing of an unborn child. She ends her testimony basically making this point. Writing about the mother of the child, she writes about how she was pressured in some way to have the abortion. Then she says about the boyfriend, he thinks it would make me sad to talk about, but I don't want our baby to think we forgot. I've never heard of anybody else having an abortion here, end quote. You'll notice she refers to this child as a baby, not as a fetus, not as unwanted tissue. She knows in her heart it's a baby. On the other hand, some women go out of their way to describe how little moral impact an abortion had on them. Maria, age 38, writing from Pennsylvania, says, We had a one-year-old and a three-year-old and hadn't envisioned having more. At first I thought, well, I love my husband and we have plenty of money. I had this naive notion that access to abortion was easy for people like us. I called my doctor who referred me to someone else because that practice didn't perform abortions. So she had to go find an abortion doctor. She writes about going back for the abortion. She says about the abortion itself and the abortion clinic, the staff was great. It felt a lot like a regular checkup, but with painful cramping. Then she writes this. My insurance covered the whole thing. In the waiting room, my husband said, Where do you want to go on vacation? Her final words, We booked a trip to Spain. Similarly, Anya, age 36, who lives in both New York and California, writes about her abortion. She says, I actively support Planned Parenthood for doing important work. But she says, I was stuck in a waiting room for hours with young girls, some flippant, some sad, and the doctor was dead-faced and didn't make eye contact. She says, I woke up in a gurney in the hallway surrounded by chaos. Nobody checked on me. That was her first abortion. Then she writes about her second abortion. The first was in 2003, the second in 2006. She writes in contrast, This time I realized I had health insurance. I made an appointment at a hospital, and the whole thing cost about $30. On the way, my boyfriend started freaking out, saying, What if you're killing my son? I had him pull over so I could drive. I respect that it was an emotional experience for him. I never think about the abortions. When I tell people, they respond with a panic face, and when I say I'm truly okay with it, they make a second panic face. I end up comforting them. End quote. Again, an incredibly revealing, deeply troubling testimony. Here you have a woman who's had not just one but two abortions and says that she's shocked by the fact that the boyfriend or the father of the second child was actually concerned that this might be killing the child. But in this case, he seems to be only concerned about killing a son. She makes him get out so she can drive. She's the calm one. And when he is troubled, she says, I respect that it was an emotional experience for him, making very clear it was not an emotional experience for her. And she goes further with this, saying that when other people are shocked that she's not troubled by this, she comforts them. Anna, age 23, from New York, had an abortion in 2007. She writes about going to an abortion clinic that turned out to be a pregnancy care center. She says, quote, they showed me the ultrasound, but I wasn't falling for that, end quote. Very interesting. What in the world does that mean, falling for that? I guess it means that she wasn't going to look at the ultrasound and see the evidence prove positive of the fact that the life inside of her was a baby and then grow reluctant to have the abortion. She had the abortion. On the other side, writes Monica, age 30, in New York, who had an abortion in 2007. Her last words are, I regretted having anything to regret, end quote. Alex, a young woman, age 24, in New York, had abortions in both 2006 and 2012. She writes, I'm pro-choice, but for some reason, I still hold a stigma for people who've had multiple abortions, and yet I've had multiple. She writes about her abortions and then ends by saying, sometimes you regret and sometimes you feel good. You think the baby would be a year old now. Again, she names it what it is, a baby. This cover story in New York Magazine is getting a lot of cultural attention because there are those applauding it on the pro-choice, pro-abortion side for saying that these testimonies help to humanize abortion, the women seeking and having abortions, in order that there would be more moral sympathy for them. And yet I don't think that's the effect of publishing an article like this. I think that's why even most in the pro-abortion, pro-choice side don't run this kind of testimony, because it is, in the end, inevitably counterproductive if you're trying to build moral sentiment for abortion. On the other hand, those who are pro-life reading these testimonies have to be reminded of the moral crisis faced by many women who are in the situations that are described by these women seeking an abortion. That's why Christians committed to the culture of life and to the fact that every single human being at every stage of life is made in God's image, and thus every life is sacred at every point in the continuum, must do everything we can to intervene in those lives, not just to prevent an abortion, but in order to help those women get to a far better place in their lives and in every dimension, medical, economic, physical, and spiritual. One of the most interesting aspects of this cover story is that it does appear in New York Magazine. That's a magazine about New York City in particular, and written with a readership in mind that is clearly referenced in New York. New York is one of the most pro-abortion metropolitan centers in America, but the issue of abortion has been controversial in New York for well over 100 years. As a matter of fact, the most influential paper in New York at present, that is the New York Times, began to build its circulation over 100 years ago by crusading against abortion. And yet the editorial board of the New York Times is avidly pro-choice, indeed beyond that, opposed to almost every sensible regulation on abortion. New York Magazine running this cover story, well, that event tells us that there is an uneasy conscience in terms of even modern New Yorkers on the issue of abortion. And we as Christians understand why. It's revealed in the fact that so many of these women, speaking about their abortions, at the end of the testimony published in this series, use that word that stands right before us in our conscience, baby. Similarly, yesterday's edition of USA Today included a major article by Richard Wolff. It's about the Supreme Court being flooded with challenges due to the very fact, as the New York Magazine article said, there have been 111 restrictions on abortion passed by various states in just the last several months. As Wolff explains, this is a pivotal time for the Supreme Court, as he cites Caitlin Borgman, a City University of New York law professor, who said, "It's a pivotal moment for the court and for the nation," she means. "The restrictions are now getting to a point where they're actually shutting down clinics," end quote. That in itself is an explosively revealing statement. In other words, finally, some of the restrictions on abortion, that is the New York Magazine article acknowledged, are even permissible under Roe v. Wade, have finally led to the point that some clinics are being shut down. Richard Wolff writes about the shutting down of clinics in this article as if that is to be understood as a barrier that no one thought would actually be crossed. I think he writes that way because it is an accurate depiction of the way that those, especially in the secular elites, have looked at the issue of abortion. They never actually thought that any constitutionally allowable restriction would lead to the shutdown of even one clinic. But in the state of Texas, it's happening. You can count on this issue soon arriving at the United States Supreme Court. As Wolff writes, the court already has on its January calendar a challenge to Massachusetts' 35-foot buffer zone around abortion clinics. Early next month, justices are likely to grant another case challenging the rule under President Obama's health care law that nearly all employers provide insurance coverage for contraceptives. Teresa Collett, a law professor at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota, said, and she's profoundly right in saying this, quote, "The stakes are higher for both sides." And indeed they are, because every time the Supreme Court returns to this issue, it has to face the issue it decided so disastrously in 1973. We must be carefully and prayerfully observing the U.S. Supreme Court as these cases arrive and will soon have their day in court. This cover story in New York Magazine and this article within yesterday's edition of USA Today are, and we need to say this again, completely shocking to a generation of those who pressed for legal abortion who thought that the issue long ago would have been settled. Justice Harry Blackmun, the Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, who wrote the majority opinion in the Roe case in 1973, said to his clerks and to the public later that he thought he was achieving a settlement on the issue. In 1973, when the Supreme Court, by a narrow majority, decided on abortion on demand in the Roe v. Wade decision, thought that it was bringing the end to a debate, not that it was accelerating and expanding it. But what we have here is testimony to the fact that the human conscience is very resilient. Even when it tries to convince itself that abortion isn't an issue, here it arrives back again. You have to know that the editors of New York Magazine are scandalized that, by their logic, they had to run this kind of cover story in their magazine, not in 1973, not in 1983, not in 93, or even just 2003, but in 2013. Christians concerned about how moral change takes place within our culture or any culture must take at least a little heart from this. Here you have the resilient witness to the reality of the sanctity of human life, and it comes through even when a culture at large tries to deny it. And once again, we see that it comes through with reference to the issue itself. It's one thing to argue over the titles like pro-life, pro-choice, pro-abortion, you name it. But there's one word that keeps coming up again and again, and that word morally trumps all others. It's that four-letter word embedded in these testimonies, baby. Several major newspapers this week are dealing with another very different kind of story, and it too is very revealing. The Associated Press ran a story that is run in the Washington Post and many other papers. The headline in the Washington Post is this: a megachurch where God is unwelcome. Atheists unite at Sunday assemblies across the United States and the globe. We reported on this story elsewhere before, especially in London, where the so-called Sunday assemblies emerged as organized churches for atheists. There's so much to consider here. First of all, you have the testimony, very implicit, if not explicit in this kind of news story, that human beings are innately religious. Even atheists are increasingly religious about their atheism. Augustine, that great church father from the 5th century, put it very simply when he said, "Our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee." In other words, even atheists are demonstrating the restlessness of their hearts by trying to emulate Christianity, even organize Christianity, by establishing what they even dare to call churches or assemblies in order to gather together to draw fellowship from other atheists. But of course, it's never just fellowship. The motto of the Sunday assembly is, and I quote, "Live better, help often, wonder more." Well, you think about that and just think about the last two words, wonder more. In other words, there are transcendent thoughts that come out in the atheist assemblies simply because they gather together and have to talk about meaning. Well, what should we see by this? Christians should see a testimony not only to the innate religiousness of human beings. John Calvin put it differently when he talked about the seminas divinitas. He said every single human being has a seed of God's knowledge planted within them. This is what Paul's talking about in Romans chapter 1, when he writes that we are all without excuse because God has revealed himself in nature. And as Paul makes clear in Romans chapter 2, that includes in the human conscience. We can try to deny it, but it comes out in a hunger for the knowledge of God that is revealed in this case by atheists establishing what they call Sunday assemblies, identified by the Washington Post and by Religion News Service and the Associated Press as atheist megachurches. By the way, let's look at that for just a moment. According to the Associated Press, nearly three dozen gatherings dubbed atheist megachurches by supporters and detractors has sprung up around the U.S. and Australia, with more to come. After finding success in Great Britain earlier this year, the movement, fueled by social media and spearheaded by two prominent British comedians, is no joke. Well, here's one thing that is at least of some concern. You're talking about a group of some 400 people gathered together, according to the Associated Press. Just consider the fact that there are tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of Christian churches across the United States every Sunday that are numbering more than 400 in attendance. Put bluntly, 400 does not a megachurch make. Speaking of the church in Los Angeles, the Associated Press reports it looked like a typical Sunday morning at any megachurch, hundreds packed for more than an hour of rousing music, an inspirational sermon, a reading, and some quiet reflection. The only thing missing was God. Well, oddly enough, I'd have to counter by saying God is not as missing as they would like to think he is or to claim he is. You're talking about a church, you're calling it a megachurch. You're talking about an assembly, and you have the reporter on the event saying that the one who is missing is God. Well, if you have to mention he's missing, then guess what? He's not as missing as you would like to think or to claim that he is. The Associated Press puts this in the context of the growing secularization of the United States, and that's undoubtedly true. One out of five Americans, according to the Pew Center, are identifying themselves as nuns, those having no religious preference. One out of three for those who are 30 and younger. As the Associated Press reports, the movement dovetails with new studies showing an increasing number of Americans are drifting away from any religious affiliation. And yet what they seem to miss is the fact that if they're going to the Sunday assembly, they're not drifting away as much as they may want to think they are. There's another agenda here, too. As the Associated Press reports, this also plays into a feeling among some atheists that they should make themselves more visible. Well, they've been very visible and very vocal of late. But if they think it's going to serve their cause to be more visible in something that gets dubbed an atheist megachurch, my guess is they're not doing themselves any favors. And so the bottom line in all of this is that the atheist megachurch points out the centrality of the church in God's purposes for humanity, and that in itself is worth our noting. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/AlbertMohler. For more information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for the briefing.